and welcome to episode 15 of Railway Mania. The podcast has been going for over a year now, and I'm over the moon with how it's been received. I wanted to thank all of you for listening and hope you stick with it for many more episodes to come. It's been a while since I've done a solo podcast episode, but I've been incredibly lucky to have so many excellent guests on the show. There never seemed to be the time to record anything. I have an incredibly long list of subjects I want to cover, with more being added all the time. But what got me thinking about this episode's subject was in 2019, when the travel agency Thomas Cook announced it was closing. This company was a pioneer of the holiday and tourism scene, and it was around for 178 years. In an amusing twist, the modern boozy package holiday owes much of its origins to an 11-mile trip taken by a party of teetotalers in 1841. Thomas Cook was born in Derbyshire in 1808. Apprenticed as a cabinet maker, he was a deeply religious man and a supporter of the temperance movement. Whilst walking from Market Harbour to Leicester in order to attend a temperance society meeting, Thomas had the idea of using the new railway system to assist in getting like-minded people to and from gatherings. This was the golden age of railway mania, with new railways opening across the country every year, linking up to form the dense network of the Victorian era. In May 1840, the Midland Counties Railway had opened its new extension from Nottingham to Leicester. It was on this route that, on the 5th of July 1841, Thomas Cook took 500 temperance supporters, who all paid a shilling each, from Leicester to a rally in Loughborough. Within 10 years, he was arranging for 150,000 people to attend the Great Exhibition in London. What had started as a relatively small endeavour became a tourism empire stretching across Europe, and Thomas Cook himself became a household name. But was Cook the sole innovator of the tourism industry? Whilst the Leicester to Loughborough trip was a landmark event for his empire, it was by no means the first such excursion. The first recorded excursion train is said to have taken place on the pioneering Liverpool and Manchester Railway. In his book Fire and Steam, Christian Woolmar records that 150 school teachers hired a train of second-class coaches from Liverpool to Manchester and back, not long after the line started operations. In August 1840, a year before Thomas Cook's inaugural trip, the Yorkshireman published this report on a monster train. Here's the quote. "Steam travelling extraordinary. Leicester, Monday. About 12:30 this day, a train, the longest perhaps ever known, came along the Midland Counties Railway from Nottingham. It had four engines to drag it forward, and to the beholders appeared like a moving street, the houses of which were filled with human beings. The occasion of this extraordinary sight was a return visit made by the committee and friends of the Nottingham Mechanics Exhibition to this town. The number of carriages was 67, and the quantity of passengers nearly 3,000. Unfortunately for railway enthusiasts, the article does not describe how they were able to detrain everyone at the destination, 67 carriages being quite a bit longer than the platforms of the time, such as they were. 4 years later, a procession of monster trains, four in total, made up of a reported 240 coaches and 10 locomotives, carried 6,600 people from Leeds to Hull. In her thesis, The Million Go Forth, and the book of the same name, Dr. Susan Major uses contemporary press accounts to take a deeper look at the role that other entrepreneurs, aside from Cook, as well as the railway companies themselves, took in relieving the social pressures of the 1840s and 50s. Major argues that the Thomas Cook Company history portrays a skewed view of the industry, and her work seeks to shed more light on the various groups involved. She also points out that the advantages of using the press as a reference rather than relying solely on railway and travel companies' own history, which can be a rather cold list of ticket sales. The printed and personal accounts of the time can offer a window into the human experience and the feelings of the first railway tourists. She describes the phenomenon of the excursion as a tool for rational recreation by urban elites, a possible source of profit by railway companies, a threat to Sunday observance by the Sabbatarians, a fear for public safety by the government, a competitive concern by the steamer companies, but importantly, a way of accessing new space by the masses. The aforementioned Liverpool-Manchester Railway, opened in 1830, was different from its predecessors in that it appealed directly to passenger travel. Up to then, most railways had been primarily for the transportation of goods and minerals. Passenger demand on the L&M exceeded even what the promoters had forecast. In 1844, Sir Robert Peel's government passed the Railway Regulation Act, which required railway companies to provide affordable transport to the working classes. It is often said that the companies were reluctant to cater to such a crowd, evidenced by early third-class carriages being little more than open wagons, sometimes even forming part of goods trains. The Act required the provision of at least one train a day each way at a speed of not less than 12 miles an hour, including stops, which were to be made at all stations, and of carriages protected from the weather and provided with seats, for all which luxuries not more than a penny a mile might be charged. Whilst the parliamentary trains, as they were known, are not railway excursions, they do indicate the population's desire for travel. The government saw these trains as necessary to enable people to find work amidst the vast and sprawling population centres of the Industrial Revolution. Tourism itself was not a new concept during this period. The upper classes were quite accustomed to taking long trips around Europe by sea and carriage. It was the affordability of rail travel that opened up so many short excursion opportunities to the working classes. The author Jack Simmons in The Victorian Railway asserts that it was the scale and scope of tourism and leisure that changed so dramatically from the mid-19th century onwards. In Lancashire, before the coming of the railways, thousands of people would flock to seaside towns such as Blackpool on foot or using heavily laden carts. Not quite the same ordeal as dragging a wheeled suitcase through an airport these days. Lancashire and the North West stand out in studies of tourism development, as the cotton-producing towns tended to have longer consecutive summer holidays than anywhere else in England, as well as a history of savings clubs. These factors better enabled mass tourism that was slower to develop in other parts of the country. The North East was not excluded from such endeavours, though. As early as 1835, the Leeds and Selby Railway ran trips from Leeds to Spurn Point, with the passengers changing onto a steamship, appropriately named Railway, at Selby. For Good Friday in 1841, the York and North Midland was advertising two trains departing York and heading out to Leeds and Hull, which I find amusing given that nowadays day trippers would likely be heading in the opposite direction. The influence of groups such as the Temperance Movement and Mechanics Institutes were vital in these early days. Without a guaranteed number of ticket sales, the railway companies would have been unlikely to risk the cost of running special excursion trains. The first recorded instance of such a service being referred to as a monster train was in the Leeds Mercury of August 1840, describing 1,250 textile workers in 40 carriages heading from Leeds to Hull on a day trip. The day trip itself was influenced by the early steamship companies, which recognised that their clientele would have had a fixed amount of time for leisure before the need to return home. Most trips at this time took place on a Sunday, despite opposition from Sabbatarians. In the south of the country, the London and South Western Railway started operating excursions in 1841, offering cheap weekend tickets the following year. Also in 1841 was the first excursion by the Great Western, heading to London. Any mention of the GWR during this period must of course reference the broad gauge, which, as always, caused problems for through traffic, passengers having to change trains partway through the journey. A rather grisly, yet typically Victorian story, is in 1840 when 1,100 people travelled in three trains to see the public execution of the Lightfoot brothers at Bodmin Jail. As is clear from these dates, Thomas Cook was not the inventor of excursion travel by any means, but rode a wave of new public interest in excursions and capitalised upon it. In Fire and Steam, Christian Wolmar emphasises the monopoly that Victorian railway companies had on land transport, and this is reflected in their advertising. Where steamship companies would use glamorous wording about speed and power, the railways tended to display factual information on destination, times and prices. This points towards their monopoly on making this particular journey, and the fact that steamers were trying to compete with the railways for the tourist trade. Showing the changing traffic demands of the railway in the aftermath of the 1844 Act and the spread of cheap travel, in 1846 third-class passengers provided 20% of the total revenue, but by 1870 this had more than doubled to 44%. Railway companies were forced to move towards a high-volume, low-margin business model, the opposite of the bulk mineral traffic that provided the genesis of the technology. I've heard it said about some of the early north-east coal railways that the first load of coal in the morning would pay for everybody's wages on the railway. The roughly categorised British working class in the 1850s represented about 60-70% of the total population of 27 million people. In 1850, the GWR was claiming that excursion traffic was increasing their weekly receipts by £2,000. The chairman at the time said that excursion traffic was cheaper to run as it was heavily loaded but required only one locomotive and crew. Not all railways were content with excursions and special trains, though. There were fierce price wars fought between the Great Northern, the Midland, and the London and North Western railways around the time of the 1851 Great Exhibition. The Midland claimed that half their ordinary passenger traffic was affected, because they were forced to offer such cheap tickets over relatively short distances. They also complained that it diverted regular traffic. Similarly, the Great Northern Railway had to cancel the discounted rates they were offering, as their trains had to operate via the Manchester, Sheffield and Lincolnshire line. The toll paid to this company was such that they were in danger of operating these trains at a complete loss. It was suggested that the income generated from running excursions should be retained by the company and not paid out as dividends to the shareholders, owing to the strain this traffic put upon the equipment and infrastructure of the railway. As an example of adapting the infrastructure to meet this demand, the Bristol and Exeter Railway, later absorbed by the Great Western, undertook constructions of extra-long excursion platforms at Weston-super-Mare and Bristol in 1854, specifically to cater to this traffic. These were not the only ones of their type, with many resorts having much longer platforms than the population size would suggest. I remember reading a piece of reporting on the preserved North Yorkshire Moors Railway, where it was claimed that for every pound spent on the railway, £2 were being spent in the local community. Similarly, in this period, the benefits of excursions to a local economy were being recognised and promoted. At an 1852 temperance demonstration in Sheffield, it was estimated that total spend by the travellers amounted to nearly £1,500. During a six-month period in 1857, it was reported that approximately 12,000 excursion passengers alone came through Chester Station, on top of the 50,000 ordinary passengers. Something that comes up again and again in contemporary reports of early excursions is a comment upon the behaviour of the crowd. As the working class grew and subdivided into yet more classes within itself, so did the public perception of large groups of people. The infamous Peterloo Massacre of 1819, when armed cavalry charged into 60,000 demonstrators, was still a sore spot in the public psyche. Mass gatherings and crowds had often been associated with civil unrest, so it is interesting that well-behaved crowds were considered notable by the newspapers throughout the 19th century. However, this may have also been a reliance on a publicly accepted narrative by writers who were on a deadline. In 1844, the Northern Star accused the York Courant of such an act of clairvoyance when the latter reported an excursion train returning at 6 p.m. full of happy passengers. The Star pointed out that its rival paper had been printed and delivered 3 hours before the train arrived. Whilst this might mean that such accounts of good behaviour may not always have been true, the stories from history tell us as much about the storyteller as they do about the events themselves. Reading the accounts, there is almost a sense of relief that comes through that the lower classes were showing signs of bettering themselves and not conforming to a negative stereotype. Dr. Major points out the themes of such a narrative. The positive view of crowds is an attempt to move away from the idea of crowds as potential rioters, accompanied by a lack of damage at the host destination being important to that place's economy. The passengers having an admiration for all they saw is described as a patronising view of the working classes. She notes that the newspapers were reliant on advertising, and the railway companies were big spenders in this regard, so a message of praise to the companies in any excursion reporting was essential. A wish to report on the positive behaviour of crowds was a reflection of the political situation of the 1840s. Riots were a source of concern as campaigns waged war on aspects of life such as the Corn Laws, which were repealed in 1846. There was also a desire to distance these activities from the drunken disorderly behaviour seen at race meetings. Sometimes the relentlessly upbeat nature of the reporting seems at odds with the subject matter. In 1852, the Bilbury Reservoir near Holmfirth collapsed, causing 81 deaths and massive property destruction in the valley below. Not even 2 months later, a special train visited Holmfirth from York, carrying over 200 people to see the destruction firsthand. The Yorkshire Gazette described the day as beautifully fine and true to form, reported the sightseers returning home in perfect safety at 8:30. Maybe this is just indicative of human nature. The massive view counts of disaster compilations on YouTube these days is likely from the same morbid curiosity as in Victorian times. This is just a tiny snapshot of the massive boom in railway tourism and leisure that occurred in the mid to late 19th century from the organisers, operators and reporters' point of view. But what was the human experience of this travel like? Whilst there is a fantastic primary resource in the form of newspaper articles, this only paints the public-facing side of the story. Unfortunately, first-hand accounts are much rarer, especially from working-class people, but they are essential to understanding what monster trains were really like. The idea of sociability in enclosed spaces has a lot to do with the idea of there being no escape for the duration of the journey. Remember that at this time that there were no corridor connections on railway carriages and no way of walking from one to another safely. A busy street may have just as many people as a coach, but they are generally on their way somewhere else and have the ability to move on. In 1910, George Simmel commented on the embodiment of sociability as conversation with no business interaction involved, where the act of talking is an end in itself. Susan Majors points out that there are few better examples of this kind of sociability than in a packed railway carriage on an excursion train. This is exemplified in a letter published by the Daily News in 1857, written by an anonymous London labourer. In describing his impulsive return trip to Salisbury aboard a London and South Western Railway open carriage, he remarks upon meeting new friends, saying, "There is no place more favourable for forming acquaintances than an excursion train, and before we got well clear of the tiles and chimney pots, we were all thick as oats in a bin. My cheroots became public property, and everyone's glasses at my service. The golden age has come again, and we have all things in common." The author also states that the open carriage was favoured above those with roofs, which may say more about the conditions inside the third-class covered carriages than the passengers' preference for fresh air. An amusing scene is recounted when the train stops under a bridge, and the passengers were heckled from above by the local children. Benjamin Brierley, writing of a trip from Ashton to Worksop in 1860, was looking for his friends on the crowded platform as the 6 a.m. train prepared to leave, eventually finding them in what he described as a hot pea establishment on wheels, or a tripe stall. The comparison to a market stall is apt, as this carriage was in fact a luggage wagon, given seats and with a canvas cover held up by poles. The only possible views out of the wagon were by lifting up the canvas and peeking through the gap. It seems that this rudimentary tent carriage was not effective in any case, as he describes getting completely soaked on the way home in a 4-hour downpour. Early rolling stock was not fitted with continuous brakes, and the converted wagons seem to have only had dumb buffers, usually solid wood rather than any sort of springing. Later in the railway's history, screw or instanter couplings enabled wagons and coaches to be buffered up, and the coupling tightened so that the buffers were in constant contact. Not so on these tripe stalls on wheels, which would bump into each other and then away, with the coupling going slack and tight all the time. Brierley states that heads are brought into mutual contact without introduction. Despite the discomfort, Brierley seems to have enjoyed the trip out with his friends, all singing and joking together. At this point in time, short of falling off a cliff, a speeding train was the fastest mode of transport on Earth. Whilst the excursion trains were not crack expresses, for many people it still held a large degree of novelty. Brierley comments upon some of his fellow passengers expressing concern at going over a viaduct for the first time. For an internet-connected generation, it is difficult to put yourself in the shoes of these people, who, but for the opportunities offered by steamship and steam locomotives, would have had very limited opportunities to see anything outside of their hometown. Brierley was not the only excursionist to get a thrill from the packed-in passengers. The Rochdale-born poet Edwin Waugh said of a trip to Blackpool in 1849 that he arrived at the station along with 2,000 fellow travellers. This is a quote from his account. "I felt that the world was one house, and all men and women in it dear relations." 1 year later, he was on a similar trip, "among a lot of hearty workmen and country folk coming back from cheap trips to Wales and the bathing places on the Lancashire coast." Cheap trips was the buzz phrase of the time, just as booze cruise and all-inclusive are part of the modern lexicon. Luggage was often not allowed, and restaurant cars would not appear on British railways until the Great Northern introduced one in 1879, so passengers would sometimes conceal their refreshments. Despite this, there are numerous references to food and drink being handed around once on the train. Waugh recorded how a young lad started to sing a long country ditty. Singing in merriment plays a part in many accounts from observers and passengers alike. There is a difference in the way that this is apparently enjoyed by all in the carriage. In my own experience of train travel, singing in the carriage was often accompanied by a feeling of awkwardness from the other passengers, or, depending on if the singing was from a rowdy group, perhaps a sports team, there was often an air of tension. In contrast, the singing on Victorian excursions seems to have been part of the enjoyment of the experience, perhaps because the passengers were all in it together, and the purpose of travel was purely one of leisure. Was there more of a willingness to participate and enjoy it? Maybe it was simply a sign of the times, personal entertainment being limited to a book or newspaper. Was singing in social situations as common as costume drama musicals would have us believe? As a counterpoint to the above, the Preston Chronicle published a letter in 1842 from an anonymous source describing the two distinct varieties of traveller. Here's the quote. "Those persons who have no regard to privacy on their journey, to whom the first person they meet is the most welcome companion, and another class, who go there as a party of their own, and to whom the motley assemblage, inseparable from motley intercourse, is an intolerable annoyance. The second type of person puts me in mind of acquaintances who despise board games and other types of forced fun. A letter appeared in the Morning Chronicle in 1852, describing advertising plastered over the interior of the train. Quote, "The recent device of turning its interior an advertising van. Why, for 200 or 300 miles, should his eyes be compelled to rest upon Eureka shirts and Moses Mart, and all the polychromatic typography, which announces palatots and pothouses? A second or third class carriage, conveying 120 persons in the month of July, with barred windows, and plastered over with pictorial shirts, sophonias, and tea shops, deserves a place in one of the circles of the Inferno." This reminds me of the Central Line during rush hour when you read the same advert over and over again to avoid making eye contact with any Londoners. Thus, it was not all frivolity and fun. The open-top carriages had one obvious hazard. In 1846, two unfortunate travellers from Leeds were standing on the seats, reading their travel guide and trying to use it to identify the panoramic view around them, when a jolt threw them out of the carriage to their deaths. In 1852, a passenger commented that the crowded conditions would encourage people to lean out of the window, putting them at the risk of decapitation or maiming by signals and tunnels. That's an extreme example, but discomfort could arrive in other ways. Brierley and his friends travelled through the 4,480-metre-long Woodhead Tunnel. By the time the train broke out into daylight again 10 minutes later, every passenger's face was covered in soot. Open carriages were phased out at different times depending on the railway company. The North Eastern is reported as still using them in 1856. Smoke from a steam locomotive is acrid even in the open air. To be exposed to it for 10 minutes in the pitch darkness, in an open carriage with a press of people all around you, must have been terrifying. In the early days, it was not uncommon for open goods wagons to be used to fulfil capacity needs. Complaints were made in 1842 against the Preston Longridge Railway after they used stone wagons on Sunday excursions without bothering to clean up the sand and dirt from inside. The modern description of poor passenger accommodation as cattle trucks was sometimes a factual description of the carriages used on excursion trains. A disgruntled passenger in 1849 reported that they had been in third-class covered accommodation on the way from London to Dover for the day, but when they tried to board for the return journey, the carriage had been locked, even though there was no one inside, and the passengers were herded into what they described as sheep cars for the return journey. The reason for this bizarre company policy is unclear, though there is a theme in negative accounts of the passengers feeling like cattle being herded from one place to another. It is not often recorded how passengers dealt with the call of nature whilst being locked in such close proximity for long trips, possibly due to the sensibilities of the time, though I'm not so sure on that last point given the frankness of some of the letters. Worse than the constant jolting was the threat of an accident, to which excursion trains were more prone than others. A trip from Blackpool to Manchester in 1849 had so many passengers that extra stock was attached at Preston. This was old and unsuitable for the job, and despite the snail's pace of 4 miles per hour, the extra carriages became detached twice, the resulting jolt causing black eyes and bloody noses. A breakdown would cause chaos, especially before the telegraph system was widespread, when sending for relief could take hours. Due to the overcrowding, thousands of people could be affected by a single failure. In 1846, the Board of Trade issued a report with safety recommendations due to concerns about standards on excursion trains. The report included mentions of couplings breaking, causing carriages to roll back down inclines, as well as inadequate staffing, such as guards to operate the handbrakes. If you mention the practice of travelling on the roof of a train, images of crowded services in India in the late 20th century may spring to mind, but it was done in Britain in the early days of the railways too. Susan Majors looked into reasons for roof travel, which vary from bravado and anti-authoritarian behaviour of boisterous young men, to it being an accepted practice in the 1830s, possibly carried over from stagecoaches. Quite often it is the result of inevitable overcrowding. The danger of this is clear. In The Million Go Forth, there is an excerpt from an 1844 report on a fatal accident. Mr. Thomas Wiley, a spirit merchant, had been organising several monster trains from Sheffield to Hull, utilising 170 carriages. Mr. Wiley had sold over 4,000 tickets by the time the Sheffield station staff asked him to stop, as there was no space for the passengers. Nevertheless, they were crammed into the procession of trains. Several passengers climbed out onto the roofs to escape the crush, making use of the seats on top, which were possibly there for the use of the guard, although some railways did permit and encourage roof travel. The staff reported telling the roof riders to get down, but received saucy answers in return. Tragedy struck when a coupling on the first train snapped, causing it to stop, and the second train bumped into it. The low-speed impact was enough to topple several people off the roofs, and a young man was killed. The danger was not solely from accidents either. One's fellow passengers could be equally unpleasant. An 1851 court case was brought against an elderly surgeon accused of assaulting a 14-year-old girl in an excursion carriage. The girl in question, though surrounded by people, felt unable to call for help from those around her as she was too ashamed. The lack of light inside the carriages, compounded when going through tunnels, often made for an unsafe environment for women, who could be assaulted by men attempting to kiss or molest them in the darkness. An 1859 case, where a man was charged with assaulting a woman in a tunnel during a trip, caused comment from the bench that this behaviour required clamping down upon to stop the spread. In her examination of the human behavioural attitudes that formed around excursion trains, Majors points out that several all-female trips took place, presumably in response to this threat. She also notes emerging trends in group behaviour, where passengers might band together to protect their space, such as blocking the doors to prevent more people from being crammed into the carriages. This caused at least one excursion agent to complain that such defensive space caused delays, as they could not find seats for everyone who had bought tickets. The railway companies did not take kindly to group acts of protest. An 1843 trip, upon arriving at Manchester, was informed that the person who had taken their money had gone missing with the proceeds, and that they would have to pay again for the return journey. The group responded by taking possession of the carriages and refusing to pay. The railway company's answer to this was to uncouple the locomotive and drive off, leaving the carriages and passengers behind. The crush of crowds at stations was an obvious safety and admin nightmare, not only to get people on the trains, but also to be able to take tickets. Some stations would lock the doors before excursionists arrived to prevent crowds forming inside. In one distressing incident, a group of several thousand people all trying to get into Birkenhead Station caused at least one woman to faint and fall underfoot. The railway staff reportedly beat the crowds about the head with wooden sticks in an attempt to get them to retreat. Not the ideal way to start a day trip. During the 1857 excursion season, the South Eastern Railway thought it adequate to provide a staff contingent of 2 people to process 300 people at London Bridge Station, including weighing and registering baggage. As a result, the crowd quickly became unruly, fearful of missing their train. Apparently, men's coats were torn off their backs, women's bonnets smashed, and a few crinolined females came out of it flattened like pancakes and bruised like oats. However, Majors points out that the public concerns about the safety of excursion trains did not seem to deter them from using them in the slightest. Christian Wolmar points out that for some, the excursion train might have offered people their first ever glimpse of the sea. As someone who grew up in an old Victorian seaside resort, I cannot imagine what it must have been like for someone to have never experienced the seaside, or to have even seen it. It's such a contrast to today's information and image-saturated life, where we have the luxury of getting detailed views of faraway places from our laptop screens. This explosion in available experiences may have had huge effects on the mentalities of the passengers. As an example, Joseph Gutteridge wrote of his trip to the Great Exhibition of 1851 that the treasures kept in my mind a state of continual excitement for some time. And what of Thomas Cook? Well, despite him not being the first excursion agent, and the fact that his trips appealed less to the masses and more to the middle classes, his name is still synonymous with the subject. After his initial trip in Leicestershire, he went from strength to strength. In 1845, one of Cook's parties went from Leicester to London. The next year, he began his famous tours where 350 people went all around Scotland. By 1850, the tours had expanded to Europe, visiting Belgium, Germany and France, finishing in Paris for the Great Exhibition. In this way, Thomas Cook was one of the forerunners of the circular ticket, allowing travel across many differing railway companies on a single ticket. His impact on the Italian economy and its new currency, the lira, was notable, but perhaps that's a story for another day. Cook retired in 1878 and moved back to Leicester, where he lived until his passing in 1892. The brand of Thomas Cook lived on under the stewardship of John Mason Cook and his sons. In 1924, the company was sold to the Compagnie Internationale des Wagons-Lits, ending the Cook family ownership. Thereafter, many owners and operators of Thomas Cook came and went, but the brand endured until the 22nd of September 2019, when Thomas Cook closed its doors for the final time. In researching this podcast episode, I have leaned heavily on the work of Dr. Susan Major, whose thesis, The Million Go Forth, provided the majority of information and references. Susan has written a book based on this thesis, called the Millie and Go Forth, early Victorian railway excursions. I have barely scratched the surface of this fascinating topic, so I highly recommend purchasing a copy of the book. I also have to cite Fire and Steam by Christian Wolmar for introducing me to the subject. A link to both of these will be provided in the description. Thank you, as always, for listening. Maybe you learned something. Hopefully it was entertaining. Be sure to check out railwaymania.net for more episodes. Let me know what you think. On the site I have a contact form. I've had a few glitches with this which resulted in me losing several emails, so if you've not heard back from me, I do apologise. I've not deliberately ignored you, and hopefully the system is working okay now. Thanks once again for tuning in. I'll be back with more Railway Mania soon.